Right, good morning to all. We're just about to start. We'll start about 1 minute. Continue with Kohelos in chapter 3. Sense a little unsurety about that.
Oh.
Morning, Rabbi.
Hi, how are you?
Good morning, good morning.
My energy's a little low this morning.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, who is that?
Oh, it's Doug. It's
Doug?
Probably just the allergies.
Good
morning, Ruth.
Oh, good morning. I'll help you feel better.
Thank you.
Okay, and Mike is on with us on the internet from Ohio. Good morning, Mike. Good to see you.
And Jenna's there, too.
What's that?
Jim, I heard Jim before, also.
Okay.
Yes, I'm here.
Yeah. All right. So, we're in Chapter 3, and the last time, a few weeks ago, we had touched on the two topics, which was insecurity and happiness. And we had mentioned that why is it that King Solomon is teaching us that there's a time for everything? So we said, we need to say that different attitudes or different actions, there's a time when it's appropriate, meaning to say there's a time when it's not. But why does he have to tell us this? Evidently, you know, I repeat this many times, but it's a very important lesson in terms of understanding how the Torah is written. And that is that we are being told something because we would think otherwise. So evidently, in this case, we would think that things are not limited to just a few moments in time for being appropriate. We would think that certain attitudes or actions might always be appropriate. So it's important for King Solomon to tell us that that's not true. But now that we realize what he is speaking against, meaning what exactly, you know, in the human personality is he addressing? And so that's only the illustration, meaning we have to understand what's the underlying psychological principle that's at work. So if a person is looking to always have something he can point to and say, this is always a good, but King Solomon now has to tell us, no, there's a time for this. A time for killing, there's a time for healing, a time for gathering, a time for destroying, a time for love, a time for hate. Meaning that you cannot look at anything and say that this is always a good. So now we ask the next question. The next question is, well, why is it that we want to say something is always a good? So what we answered was that a person is insecure by nature. And there's, of course, a need for that element in our personality, otherwise it would not have been created. But that insecurity is something which forces a person to want to look for some security, to feel good. So he'll look at something and he'll say, oh, this is a good always, which is not an appropriate response, because a person is going to say love is always good. Well, if he loves an enemy, he can get killed doing that. So what has to override all of these assessments is wisdom. Wisdom has to be what's guiding us, not the action. Now, we're in a physical world. And that's the danger. The danger is that we can get attached to the physical and point to objects and look for that type of security, say that this is always a good. But of course that is the physical world is really a creation of God's wisdom. So wisdom, which is not physical, is of a higher caliber, because wisdom is what guides the entire universe. Without God's wisdom, there would not be the universe. And the universe is really an expression of wisdom. So if we understand the wisdom, we understand how to interact with the universe. If we don't follow wisdom, so then our interaction with the universe could be fatal, or even less than that. It could be a very upsetting type of existence if we don't follow wisdom. So that's a very, very important lesson he's giving us here. So you see how the approach that we have to cultivate as we study is to understand the method of the lessons of King Solomon. And again, this works with all of Torah. Anytime we see an idea and we're told not to do something, evidently it's because there's a predisposition that a human being wants to do that, or many people want to do that. If we're told that something is really not a good, then we have to understand, we might think that it is, but then we have to understand what is the problem with it. So that's what we're doing here. We make a couple of steps and we slowly get down to the core, and we see that what King Solomon is illustrating is an insecurity in man. So that's why he says, he goes through eight verses, telling you different examples of right, he says a time for birth and time for death. Right, the time for planting, the time for reaping, time for killing, and a time to heal. I mean, all of the most basic, most primary attitudes and actions he discusses. Crying and laughter, eulogy and dancing, destruction and gathering, embracing and distancing oneself. And then he says a new verse in 9, where he says, what extra is there to the one who performs with all that he works? Now let's see if we can go a little further now and start unraveling a bit more about these verses. I know that we read through, because Ibn Ezra says in his commentary on verse 12 that all these verses until verse 16 are all connected. So that means there's a theme, and there's one verse follows the next because it's subsequent in terms of the idea. It's connected. It follows. So what follows? How does 9 follow the previous verses? So take a few moments now and take a look. How does 9, verse 9, follow the previous verses? And we'll have to ask the same about the next verses as well. But let's just understand what he's saying. And we have to have the proper explanation before we can try to see the connection. So the explanation is, what extra is there to the performer in that he labors, in that which he labors? And see if we can use the approach that we've just reviewed.
Rabbi, could it be that it is that if there's a time for this and a time for that, and everything has its time and then it's gone and its time, a person could ask the question, so if that's true, then what good is it for me to work at anything?
Why would he say that? He's not saying that there's a time for living in a house and eating and having clothing. That's not part of the things that are dependent upon time. That is always a need.
Okay.
Yes.
Hello? Oh, I wasn't hearing anybody.
You were just thinking about it.
It's Pamela. I'm sorry, I'm sick, but I'm trying to get in the conference.
Somebody had something to say?
This is Pamela.
Yes, hi Pamela, how are you?
I'm good, I'm sick, so I apologize. I probably won't say very much.
Maybe hold the phone a little bit away from you so we don't catch anything.
I'll wear a mask. Wonderful. Naomi doesn't know which number that the class is on. I may hang up and call her and let her know where the class is, okay?
Okay, sure. Great.
Okay, I'll call you right back.
Yeah, so what is he saying over here? My Yisroen. What benefit is there? What is he talking against in the human personality is what we have to ask. And how does it follow these verses? That's what you got to think about. Not an easy question, but if we use the right approach, I think we can get the answer. I'm not promising an answer. I'm just saying that we can get the answer. Sometimes, you know, King Solomon's wisdom is amazing, so we're lucky to get what we get each week.
Rabbi?
Yeah, Cal?
I was thinking that if you put this number 9 in the same kind of sequence as the ones that came before, what gain has the worker then by his toil is to just recognize that that's a reality that you need to, that there's a time for that and then there's a time for rest or reaping the rewards of your toil.
He doesn't talk about rewards of toil. What is he asking here?
He's asking for what the gain is from the working.
Right. Now, what could that do? What does that have to do with the previous verses, or how the previous?
Well, because it's kind of doing opposites. That there's a time for this, and then there's a time for that, which is kind of the opposites of it, and to just recognize that. So if you put this in that same format, then there's a time for that toil, and then there's the time for rest.
I see what you're saying. You mean to say that just as he just outlined that no one thing is always a good, so he's now plugging this in to the attitude of a person where he's laboring for something in life.
Right.
And now he's saying, what benefit is there? I mean, are you now, I mean, in that area, are you making that same mistake? My Yisroen, what is the benefit? Meaning the person is looking for it. I mean, this very phenomena of looking for something that will offer me satisfaction 100% of the time. So, when the person is laboring, see, there is a thing called the yeser. Meaning, there is two things in a person's labor. When he's providing himself with the basic needs, because you can't say, if a guy works and he earns money, that there's, you can't ask a question and say, what good is that? Well, of course it's good. That was Doug's question. The cost, there's a good in the person's labor. So evidently it's not the compensation and how it addresses his needs. That's not what he's addressing. He's saying the yeser, the additional, meaning there's, again, this is something which Rabbi Chan had brought up, you know, when he gave these classes years ago, and he talked about that my Yisroel Adam, that at the very beginning of the book, starts off with this very statement. And he says, in verse 3, chapter 1, verse 3, what additional gain is there to a man in all his work that he works under the sun? So, I mean, he's looking for something more, whether it's the fantasy of being a big executive or other types of assumed greatness and grandeur. It's fantasy, basically, if you wanted to categorize it. There's the real good that the person gets, but then there's the fantasy attached just to it. That's why Rabbi Chaim explained the second verse, when he says, these are the words, he opens up the book and saying, these are the words of Kohelis, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. And the very next verse, you remember, King Solomon says, a futility of futilities, says Kohelis, which Kohelis has different explanations. In Hebrew, it means that it's like a gathering. He always spoke in groups. So you can know that his words, his education, whether they were tried and tested by other intellectuals. So what he's writing down is not just, quick thoughts. These are ideas that were discussed, and there were conclusions that were, agreed to. There was consensus. So when he says a futility of futilities, so it means to say, according to Rabbi Chait, a beautiful idea that there is the futility is where a person is running after the physical world as an ends in itself. That's one futility, because you really should use it as a means. The physical world should serve as a means of approaching God. But if you use it as an ends in itself, he's just a glutton, a hedonistic person, so then that's futile. Then his whole pursuit is going to be a waste of time. But on top of that, there's another futility, and that is the fantasy that a person attaches to that, where he assumes, I'm going to buy this great fancy car, this yacht, I'm going to become a great executive, I'm going to build an empire. So those that which is fantasy, by definition, is futile, because it's only existing in the fantasy. There's never any attainment of it. There's never any satisfaction. It's always a person thinks that this is going to give him something. So that's the second futility. That's the extra. So when he uses the term Yisron, meaning what additional you go get to get? That means the person is looking for additional. All right? So the word again is being used here in our verse, 3:9, where he says, what additional? What additional is there to the one who performs? So why does he bring that up here now, after he talks about these eight verses about time for this and time for that? So Cal is suggesting that because of the person's life where he labors, he tries to do that. He's trying to get that stability in his work, which I agree. Meaning when a person attempts to paint certain pictures in his mind, have fantasies about what he's going after, part of the fantasy is that it's permanent. That's also, I believe, something Rabbi Chait laid down, that when a person has a fantasy about something, and you think about it, we've done this, every single human being, nobody is immune to having fantasized about a certain thing in life, whether it's a vacation or a new object or whatever it is. When we do the act of thinking about it, imagining, planning, and we construct this fantasy in our head, it's pristine and it's endless. There's two main factors in a fantasy. Because if we thought that in our fantasy we're going on vacation, it's not going to be thundering and raining the entire time we're there, we can't fantasize things like that. We fantasize because we're looking for an escape from a current dissatisfied state, and we look for a state which is perfect, pristine. But underneath the heading of it being pristine and perfect, not only in terms of the design, the structure of the event that we're thinking about doing, whether, let's say it's a vacation somewhere, for Bermuda or something. So not only does the construction in our minds have to be perfect, but also the duration has to be without limit. Otherwise, it impedes on the desire that we want. Now, why must it be that it's perfect and it has an endless duration? I mean, in our minds, we know we're going for a week or 2 weeks, but when we think about it, time comes to a standstill. As it's picture perfect setting, everything goes well. We don't get any type of stomach cramps from the water, and we don't lose our luggage. None of these things that happen all the time are part of the fantasy. we do that. We
Rabbi,
just,
excuse me.
Yes?
Yeah, ask a question. Does that mean that we're not dealing with reality when we do that? We're not...
That's right.
It's so pure. That's so... Okay.
Right, evidently that our current reality is not satisfying. So we look for something to escape to.
Rabbi?
Yes.
It kind of makes me think about people, at least movements towards world peace and everything, and that everybody wants to envision this world where everybody gets along, but the reality is that that's never going to happen.
That's not true. The prophet says it will. Eventually it will happen. But they're not going about it the right way. They don't realize that the real enjoyment in life, the perfect state, is going to be when they can say the words, "Our ancestors bequeathed to us a false religion." That's what the prophet says they have to say.
Can you repeat that again, please?
Yeah, our ancestors bequeathed to us a false religion. They have to be able to say that.
Uh-huh.
Meaning, the reality of that all the other religions will come to eventually, the prophet talks about. I think it's the Hebrew words Afshekar Hinchelu Avoseinu. Maimonides brings that down when he talks about the future. And he says, you know, in the times of the Messiah. And again, it talks to other cases where it says no nation will lift a sword to fight each other anymore. But it'll be complete. I mean, again, free will will still exist. And all the Torah is something which is not going to ever end. It'll never be changed. That means laws about murder and stealing and incest and dishonest gain and everything else still have to apply, evidently because the human being is still going to have the same psychological structure and the same frailties. But on the whole, the world is now going to be in recognition of Torah and Judaism, and they'll be running after the Jew in order to be taught, because they'll realize the truth. So we're talking about the grand scale. But it would seem to me, though, that because of that truth, there would be a great decline in all these different things, like death, you know, murder, I mean, and stealing, and all these different things. It has to be. There's still, you know, there's always going to be deviance. But hopefully the society itself will have a certain healing aspect to it, now that knowledge is at the core, and the self is now not. Because today's society is, how can I advance my personal desires the most? I am the most important, everybody else is just a rung on the ladder for me to step on. But that will change.
Rabbi?
Yeah.
When I look at all these previous verses, they seem to me to be kind of almost opposites of each other. And in all the teachings of the Torah, it's about seeking balance. And it makes me think that if you can accept and be in tune with recognizing that there's a time for this and a time for that, then that's the sense of peace that you get, because you're not working against this reality.
Right. Exactly. Well put. Yeah, the person is not focused on getting the happiness from the thing itself, because... See, what the person is trying to do is also, what does he say in verse 9? He says, what benefit is there to the laborer? Meaning to say, oh, the laborer is assuming something that King Solomon has to now correct. That's a corrective statement. He's saying, what benefit really is there to the person who does the labor? That must mean that the person is looking for something. This is going to do something for me somehow. No, what this is going to do is provide you with your money. That's the good. But if you're looking for the additional, if you're looking for the fantasy, if you're looking for that area, if that's what you're trying to do, that's going to fail. So the person, meaning to say the time and place for everything comes first. It tells you that things have their time and place. But the reason why the person is trying to look at something and say, oh, this is always a good, why he makes an incorrect statement, because he's, again, the ego is involved somehow. That's what it means. What is there to the worker? You see that nuance? You see that it's just a plain reading of the verse. King Solomon is questioning that. That means he's questioning the assumption that people have, which is wrong. You think that there's a benefit to you somehow? Other meaning an extra benefit, outside of the fact that it covers your expenses to live and your clothing and your food. That makes sense. That's a reality that you can't question. But it's the extra. The person is looking for something extra. Like we said in the beginning, according to Rebbe Chait's explanation, the Yisron, which means extra, the additional the person's looking for. And that seems to be stemming from the ego. How am I going to be advancing somehow? How can I look at my, I mean, the self-image? You see that the self-image is something which is a part of this. Person is always looking at the self. How can I view myself right now? Very interesting thing that Rabbi Shea explained once, that the whole story about Jacob wrestling with the angel really wasn't an angel. He says that he was left alone, and this is when, you know, his brother Esav was now approaching 400 men, and he felt threatened because Jacob had bought the birthright, even though it was his, but Esav viewed it as, you know, a robbery, that he stole it from me. So this is finally the confrontation years later, decades later, when finally Esav is going to meet, and now Jacob is fearing for his life. So he separated his family into two different camps in case one would be smitten, the other one could escape. And he prayed to God to help him. So he worked out a military tactic. He worked out his prayer to God. But he also worked out a bribe, and he sent gifts to his brother. And he set them apart very far, because he knew how a person would be enamored by the fact that a great gift is coming, and he sees it in the distance coming. And when that one reaches him, well, lo and behold, another one is now coming up, rising up from the horizon, another caravan of gifts. And that one comes, and then a third one, and a fourth one. So that he knew how to affect the person's psyche. But all that he knew, he wasn't 100% sure that either one of those three tactics would secure his salvation. He was very bothered. So, but it says that night he went across the river, and he was by himself. He was going back for some last possessions, whatever. And then it says that he wrestled with a man there. So Rabbi Chait asked the question, how could the verse, one verse, say that he was left alone, and then in the very verse it says, and he wrestled with a man there. If he's alone, there's no man. Startling verse. What he said was, it must mean that he was alone, but what he was wrestling with was a part of his personality. And that was a part of a personality that was awakened by the approach of Esav. So what was Esav really? Esav was a warrior. And that's really just like a person has an image in themselves. And that's what they go through, that lifestyle. They want to have the image. So they're a warrior type. And that's all there really is. There was no substance to him. There was no life of Torah ideals. Of course, the Torah wasn't given yet, but the basic principles, the fundamentals of Torah that we have today were really followed by the patriarchs and the matriarchs. So I talk about Torah that way. But what happened was, Rabbi Chait explained that when Jacob saw his brother approaching, he now was always involved in his own perfection. And then he recognized that type of an element, that self-image element. He saw he had a certain tinge of that in himself too, and he saw that was something which was not good. Even at this moment, when his life and his family's life were genuinely threatened, he was still, his mind's eye was still always reflecting on where his shortcomings might be. So that's what it means that he wrestled with a man. He wrestled with the part of himself which was the self-image that he saw was really harmful. To try to live a life where I'm just trying to project a certain image to others, or I'm trying to fill an image that I created, that's, what does that do for me? That's nothing. So that's why he conquered it that night. And that whole discussion there is really metaphoric. And you have to say it's metaphor because you can't have a contradiction in the verse. He was left alone and he wrestled a man. That's impossible. So if he's left alone, that means there's nobody there. So what he was wrestling with was that part of his personality that was awakened by the approaching Esav, the warrior. And he conquered it, it says. That's why it says the next day he was limping. Limping just means that he conquered this thing and this part of his personality, and there was a slowdown of his energy now. Because whenever you perfect yourself and you now redirect your energy to a new path in life, it's a slow process, sort of spoken of as limping. And the same thing happened by Bilaam. When he was about, he was trying to curse the Jews, and he was riding on his donkey, and there's a whole thing going on there with him and the donkeys talking. So, by the very fact that, you know, Bilaam, after his donkey starts talking to him, so he talks back, that indicates to me that that is also a vision. It's not a real physical event on earth. Because a person doesn't just talk back to an animal. If the animal's talking to you, you're astounded. You stop. You say, what's going on? But the fact that he just conversed with it like it was another friend indicates that. And in that story also, Bilaam's leg was crushed. He also went through a trauma to the leg. Why? Because there too was a story about somebody who was going on a certain path. He wanted to curse the Jews, but then he slowed down because his conscience started to bother him. Something was bothering him. Did we ever do this story together, Bilaam?
I don't know that we've covered it to this detail.
Okay. It's an amazing story. It's just a real eye-opener with all the details and how they all come together. We should really do it if we never did it. I mean, the three elements there. There was Bilaam, there was the talking donkey, and then there was the angel that only the donkey saw. We never discussed that.
No, I don't believe so.
Okay. I think we should do that. Maybe we'll do that next week. It's just an amazing story. So if you want to go over that, the beginning of that, it's in it's the Parsha coming up in a few weeks. So we don't have to wait till then to do it. It's just a real amazing, when you see it, it just gives you such a deep appreciation for how precise and amazingly insightful that the Torah is written over there. So let's just put that down for next week. That's just, I think you'll really love it. Okay. Let me just stop here and see if there's any questions or comments.
We're good here.
We're good there, okay. All right. Okay, so again, that's what's going on here, verse 9. Now, give me just 1 minute here. That's what, there's another point over here, is that when the person looks for something to say, yes, this is a good, all the time, meaning the exact opposite of what King Solomon is saying here, but perhaps when a person does that, he has this, he envisions himself, you know, in the near future, this is a good now, and why he says that is that he brings himself into a quick snapshot, and he looks at himself, you know, as doing this activity that he values. For example, he sees himself, tomorrow in the field, and he's planting. But if it's in the middle of the winter, or whatever. So maybe his aggressiveness and his desire to accomplish and to have, make more money is causing him to make a mistake because. You can't grow anything right now. It's too cold. You have to wait for the ground to thaw. But perhaps in the first thought that he has is that he looks at himself in that image. It paints a visual image. Something like, you know, when a person goes on a vacation too. He thinks in his mind. There's visuals. There's always visuals about what I'm going to do tomorrow. But the person sees himself there, perhaps. He sees himself enjoying something. He sees himself with a new car or whatever or he hears the accolades of other people. So that drives him. I was talking to a friend recently. I think I mentioned to you, it was very upset because Obama came into the presidency. And he was very frank with me. And he said, I was in law school and this and that, and I could have been the president now. And it was very bothersome, maybe because of the proximity, the closeness of age, too. And, he's in his 40s, and Obama's in his 40s. And this was disturbing. But perhaps that's also because of the image. He saw a certain image of himself that now it can't be. So it's a similar illustration in terms of how a person puts himself in the visual for the future. So maybe that's why he follows up over here and he says that he says what additional benefit is there? Meaning that the real gain is good. You've got your compensation. If you work and you make a living, you pay your bills. That is good. That is God's will. But it's the additional that you're looking for. The accolades. Or the self is somehow involved. Okay.
So, Rabbi, do you think this is getting around to all the things about, oh, gee, if I work hard at this, then I'll get a promotion, I'll get this particular status, in other words, it's everything beyond just the practicality of I work to earn a living?
Yeah.
Okay.
That type of thing where you're looking for more than what it offers is also going to be a letdown, because if and when it doesn't happen, so it's going to be very upsetting to the person. But if the person just looks at his activity as being what it affords, and that's the real worth, and that's what he's going after, so there's not going to be disappointment, because it will yield what he understands it has to yield by the laws of nature. And he'll get it, and he'll be happy with it. All right, that's what I believe he gets on, where he talks about in verse 12, where he says, I know there's no good other than the man should be happy and to do the good in his life. Meaning, what do you really experience? What is the experience? What's the reality? That's what you should go after. But you see also, he says in 13, where he says, Vagam, and also all of man, is that he should eat and drink and see himself good in all of his work. Even that is a gift of God. So, what is he saying that for? Why is he saying it's a gift of God? See, I believe there that he's trying to show you that even that is not even in man's control. Meaning, what you're trying to do and to accomplish and to have that sense of the self, he carries through. And he says, no, it's really from God. Meaning he's countering that assumption again. And we know that that's what the Talmud says, is that what a person earns during the year is all decided by God. So you go through your labor, you do everything, but you have to have the recognition that it's you're only making what you're making because God is willing that. That's what the Talmud talks about. So that is something which also should make a person relinquish his grip on the control factor that he's trying to get somewhere in terms of the self, like to reflect on the self, look what I did. So that, he's making you abandon that, the self. If you work and you earn, good, enjoy. But to now add on to that the ego satisfaction, look what I accomplished. Well, let me look at the empire I built. So now he says, no, that's from God. What you got is from God. So he's trying to eliminate the you. You see what I'm saying?
Yes, I think so.
And in 14, he follows through with this point. He says, I know that all which God has done, that will be the way it will be forever. Upon it you can't add, and from it you can't detract. And God has done this that we should fear before him. So he shows you that he takes that point home. God is really controlling it all. And you can't add, you can't change. Evidently, we have to ask the question again. Why is he telling us this? Evidently, we think the opposite, right? Again, always. If he's telling us a new point, it's to address the opposite sentiment that we must harbor in our psyches. So if he's telling us that really you can't add on to what God has done, you can't take away from it, what must be the thought that we have? It must be that we think that we can add, that we can be creators here. Meaning that he's telling you an underlying emotion, and the person may feel a sense, I cannot make new inroads. I'm going to be this great, I'm going to break new ground and all. So that's he's showing you that that is something which is an emotion that a person has. So you just see how those follow through. You see, Ibn Ezra is right, that these verses are all connected. He's following through on this theme, that the self is involved, and that gets a person into murky waters, because he keeps on looking where he can get the self-satisfaction. The ego is involved. So really, you see that, if we go back then, we went a little out of order, but you see, what does verse 10 tell us? I have seen the manner which God has given to the sons of man to afflict him. Meaning this matter, that we don't look at things and say, oh, this is good, in order to give ourselves the security. Remember, that was the first point. A person is always looking to have something which is always going to be a good. Let me point at this attitude, this thing, this is always a good. Why do I want it to always be a good? Because now I've got something which I can always feel good about. But that's not true. You have to use wisdom. Maybe it's a good now. Tomorrow, maybe it's not appropriate. But he says, why is this so? Verse 10 tells us why this is so. God has given this to the sons of man to afflict. What do you mean afflict? God does not. This is a lo inim libo in another place. I'm not sure if it's Micha or Echa, but another prophet says that God does not afflict from his heart. He doesn't try to hurt a person, just the opposite. So what does it mean here that he has given this to man to afflict him? It means he's given this trial to man to perfect him, that he should redirect his thoughts properly. So he has to remove his energies from wrong areas, and there's a certain amount of dissatisfaction in doing that, only because the emotions get attached to what you're used to, and or you know what our predispositions are. We, you know, it feels good to steal when we're a kid, but you can't do that. It would be even today. We see somebody with a beautiful, 55-carat ring. Wouldn't that be great if I could just take that and hock that and sell that? Look at all the money I can have instantaneously. Sure, it's very appealing to be rich in a few seconds. But all these things that we're predisposed to, and these emotions from youth, and things that we're used to, so they're not necessarily good. So when God gives us direction to control them and to redirect our energies, that's what it means, an affliction. Affliction means to redirect you to an area that's going to be beneficial to you. But since we start off as emotional beings and not intellectual beings, right? Because it says by Noah that the inclination of man is evil from youth. It has a 13-year head start, that we're emotionally grounded from youth. Our intellects aren't formed well until we're about 12 or 13. That's why we're not commanded in keeping the laws until that point. Right? To your point, Doug, we spoke about last week, that when the Noahide is obligated. So I know we have to still follow through on that. But you see here that verse 10 now is that God has done this in order that man should not look at things and say this is a good or always or this is a bad always. No, use your intelligence. That's the affliction he's talking about, that you should now rise above the attachment to any specific emotion or an attitude, and intelligence should be what determines, is this proper now or not? And like we said earlier, a very fundamental point is to understand that wisdom preceded the universe, God's wisdom. So that means the whole universe is really an expression of wisdom. So that's the real world. The real world is the wisdom, the ideas behind the universe. So we shouldn't be attached to the events and the attitudes that we have here in the physical world. What really is running these things by design is a world of wisdom. So if we plug into that world, then we will interact with this world properly. Because just how this world is based on God's wisdom, if we follow wisdom, which we constantly should improve and constantly learn, then our interaction with this world is going to be pleasant. There won't be conflict. And King Solomon says an amazing thing in verse 11. He says, everything is good in its time. Right, going back to the point that there's a time for this and a time for that. He says, even the world, also the world, God has placed in their hearts so they should not see the whole matter. That man should not find the whole matter that God has done from beginning to end. Which the rabbis say that God has hidden the day of death from a person. God has given a person the immortality fantasy. So he's saying this is another example of what is good in its time. Meaning just like certain events or attitudes, they have the moment when you act on it or when you don't act on it. I mean, in terms of human activity, that's what those first 8 verses were. And now he says there's another area which comes under this truism, that things are good in their time. I mean, to say that it's good that death is hidden from a man during his time on earth. There's another example, a different category, but still under the same heading of things being proper for a certain time. So why is it? Why does he have to say, why isn't it just proper always? Why is it that the ignorance or the denial of death, the immortality fantasy that we have, that's good in its time? Why isn't it just good? Why isn't it just a good period? You have the question?
Rabbi?
Yes.
Could the answer be to that if we had death sort of hanging over us all the time, it would be sort of paralyzing?
So then we should say that immortality fantasy is always a good. What do you mean it's good in its time? It seems to be it's temporarily good, even though the temporary amount of time could be decades. You know, my question is, do I say that having a tongue so I can eat properly is good in its time? Or do I say it's good always? You hear the question or no?
I think so. I mean, as far as the tongue goes, it seems like it would depend on how you use it. There could be times when it would be good if you didn't have one, depending if you can't control it. If you can control it, then it would seem like it would be a good all the time.
But controlling it would be the recognition of when. Use it when not to.
Well, yeah, perhaps, I would say with the tongue, it is a good all the time. It's just your usage of it, your control of it, your intellectual or versus your emotional attitudes is really what has to be corrected if you're misusing it, if you're speaking poorly about somebody, for example. But I said the tongue is always, that's why it's always there. In contrast, baby teeth are not always a good, that's why they fall out. Okay, it's also good that sometimes we lose certain faculties, like we get older, we may not hear so well. Perhaps that's a good because now it starts allowing the person to remove himself from the world and starts realizing maybe we should repent, but time is almost up. You know, we get to be like, 95 and we're starting to feel very frail, or 100, we live that long. Or, you know, there are people today that are living into 105, and, you know, they're rare cases, but many, life is very long today. I mean, we have so much, it's prolonging life. You know, people live so many, to the late 90s. So, we have plenty of time. But maybe even so, what he needs to say is that the day of death has been hidden, and that's a good, but for the time being. Meaning, it's not always a good. There is a certain point where a person should accept his mortality. Because a person always denies that to his last days, he'll never repent. That's my point. That's why the immortality fantasy is good for a time, even though that time could be about 90 years. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
There's a time where it's no good anymore.
I wonder if that's why it's a blessing, in a sense, that the physical body begins to deteriorate and we're stuck to accept that, in a sense, because it's going to happen anyway.
Yes.
And it's actually a benefit to us than if we lived in our beautiful, youthful bodies and then just died.
Exactly. I think there's somebody told me once that there was a saying that I think Jacob, it's up to a certain point, people would live in full health until they died, they would just expire. But Jacob or somebody had prayed to God that he should bring disease into the world for that reason. I never saw it inside.
Yeah, I think you had mentioned it once. I remember, I'm trying to think, it was a while back, you had mentioned it in reference to Jacob, people did not think about their mortality, and then he prayed for it, and at that point, that's when they started to have people would sneeze first before they would die, and there would be a warning. That's why we say, God bless you, that the sneeze shouldn't be the end of somebody's life.
You give a person a chance, a little heads up.
Yeah, exactly. They give them a warning, and I remember that vaguely. It was a very interesting point that you had made some while back.
Yeah.
It was Jacob, yeah.
Right. Okay. All right, so we'll wrap it up here. Let me just see if there's any questions, last questions before we wrap it up. Any comments or questions?
I think we're good here.
Okay. All right, so we'll do the story of Bilam and the donkey next week. I think you'll really enjoy it. I'm surprised we never did it. It's just an amazing story, but look through it. Go through the whole story about where he's on his way and he's talking to God, and God says, first don't go, and then God says, go with the men, and then the whole discussion with the donkey and then the angel, and just go through the facts and, you know, look at the commentaries too, like Rashi. If you can get a hold of Ibn Ezra, I know that that's in English now, and we'll do that a week from today. Sounds good?
Do you know who the publisher is of the Ibn Ezra's commentary?
No, but you know what you can do is you can maybe send an email to Rabbi Rosenthal, Pinny Rosenthal. His email is Rabbi Pin, like Peter Irwin Nancy, Rabbi PIN at AOL. And you let him know I'm interested too. I'd like to pick up a copy too.
Okay.
But he's the one that told me about it about a year ago. I believe it was him.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Okay, sure. And you're welcome.
Alan, Doug, I didn't register for the next class.
Because my
email wasn't working. Okay.
It's
the same
number. I think. Yeah. Okay. Thanks. And I think Pam also.
Usually,
I write that she's going to be in the class and couldn't do it either.
Okay.
I'll have to
join
you on then.
All right. So you didn't hear the class name?
Did you?
Can
you
help out with
that, John?
Hello.
Naomi.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah. I'll join the next class too.
Okay.
Okay. Hope you feel better soon.
Thank you.
Okay, everybody. Everybody have a good week. And I'll place the class online shortly. So this way, if you missed any of it, you'll be able to get it. Just give me about 10 minutes or so, and we'll put it online, okay?
Okay, thanks, Rabbi.
Okay, take care. Have a good week, everybody. Laura in Washington, Mike, Ohio, everybody else, we'll speak to you next week.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
You will.
You too.
Bye-bye,
everybody.